In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the origins of the Serenity Prayer. Now, you may well recognize the prayer, even if you don't know it by that name. It goes like this. God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. It has been widely reproduced with various changes in wording. It has been embraced by many different organizations, particularly 12-step organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous, and is certainly well known. What I think a lot of people will not know is where this prayer came from. It was, in fact, written by one of America's greatest theologians, Reinhold Niebuhr, and it was written in 1943 at the height of World War II. It is the subject of where it came from, is the subject of a book that we'll be talking about here this morning in this part of Focus 580, a book by Elizabeth Sifton. She is the daughter of Reinhold Niebuhr and is someone who herself is well known in the world of publishing and has been involved in the business for 40 years. She is currently the senior vice president of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and is author of this book that is just out. It's titled The Serenity Prayer, Faith and Politics in Times of War and Peace, and it's published by W.W. Norton, and it is indeed about the prayer and its origins. It is about her father, but it's about much more than that. And ultimately, what it is about is the role of faith in public life. So we'll talk about that. And as we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone would be welcome to call in. Ms. Sifton, hello.
Hello.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure to do so.
You said, I think, in some of the material that came with the book, that among the many things that you were not really setting out to do is do anything necessarily to polish the image of your father, as his image probably didn't need any polishing. So it wasn't really about that. Partly, I guess, it was your fascination with this particular prayer that he wrote and people's interest in it. But it seems that there's something much larger here going on, and I guess that's a clumsy way of asking you why it is that you decided you wanted to write this book.
Well, the animating impulse for it was to correct misapprehensions about the prayer and who wrote it. Mm-hmm. I was particularly amused and puzzled to learn that in Germany, for example, it was considered to be, by most people, an 18th century German prayer. I thought that was wildly ironic, considering it had been written by an American at the height of the war against Germany. And not only an American, but a German-American American.
Mm-hmm.
A person from the heartland of what had once been very German Illinois and Missouri, where he grew up. And who had been in active opposition to much of Germany's spiritual as well as political life in the 20s and 30s. My father always felt that faith should be related to political and community life. And he thought the Germans were terribly bad at, because they failed to do this. And so they purported to be good Christians while being good Nazis, as it were, which he regarded as grotesque. So I wanted to correct that misapprehension.
Hmm.
And then I got interested in writing about the whole world he came out of, because he was not alone in his interest in social betterment.
I think it is interesting, and I guess it is a tribute to just how powerful these few lines are and how they have grabbed people, that so many people have tried to take ownership of it. And first of all, as you say, people seem to think it must be very, very old. The idea that it could have just been written as recently as about 50 years ago, people seem to have trouble with that idea. But I would guess that not only do Germans think that a German wrote it, but probably if you go other places, people want to say, "Oh yes, we ultimately wrote that. It's ours."
Right. And as I say in my book, I think many Catholics, including many Catholic friends of mine, insist that St. Francis of Assisi wrote it, for example. Well, it has a kind of clarity and simplicity which seems burnished by age, doesn't it, really? Yeah. But I think it took a while for my father to arrive at that formulation of the prayer. I find in earlier prayers that he wrote hints of it and suggestions that he was moving toward this formulation. But I wanted also to explore in my book the notion of thinking about this prayer in the first person plural as well as in the first person singular, which the 12-step programs often stress, of course. I don't mean to take away from that or suggest it's wrong. I don't. I think it's a very valuable prayer for personal use, singular use. But I think it was written in the third person, as you could hear when you recited it. Mm-hmm. And I think when you think about the fact that it was written during the war, you realize that it is also a prayer about what we, together as a society, should have the courage to change, or the patience to, or the serenity to accept.
And I think that it seems to me that often that people, when people think about this, and maybe when they say it, often the emphasis is on that first part, that is the part about accepting with serenity the things that can't be changed, where it would seem to me that in his mind, I guess, that maybe the more important part of this was the injunction to change the things that should be changed.
Yes, and of course, the third is the hardest of all, which is to decide, to figure out which is which. And that's a matter that I think, and here I think the people who recite it every day in 12-step programs and so on would instinctively understand. This is something that has to be done again and again and again. You have to think about these distinctions between what needs to be changed and what has to be accepted every day and every day anew. And sometimes you will change about this. Sometimes a situation or a condition or a circumstance which you think is unchangeable, you realize is changeable and should be changed, or vice versa.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the time that he wrote it, time and the place, because this really is very much bound up with your childhood and a place that when you were growing up, you and your family spent the summer.
Yes.
This was in a small town in Massachusetts.
That's right. My father, by the 30s and 40s, my father was teaching in New York City at Union Theological Seminary. And we had long summer holidays, as academics do. And so the family went to this small town in northwestern Massachusetts, which they had heard about through friends of theirs, all of whom that were friends through very active social action connections. There was an amazing old lady. I mean, she was old to me in the 40s. I think if she were alive today, she'd be 130 or something like this. A spectacular Boston lady who had very radical politics and was very involved in all sorts of issues having to do with the betterment of workers and the unemployed and poor people. She was very vigorous in this respect. And so she approved of my father's politics, which were pretty socially progressive themselves. She also was a friend of, then in the 1930s, Professor Felix Frankfurter of the Harvard Law School, because he had espoused the cause of Sacco and Vanzetti in the 1920s. Famous cause in this part of the political world. So she got Frankfurter to come to Heath too, and she got my father to come, and then there were various other clerics and teachers at divinity schools, and even a few bishops. So, but otherwise, the town was a farming town, and all our friends there were farmers. So it was a rather unusual place, and my father used to preach and conduct services at the village church during the summer, and it was in one of those services that he first used this prayer. So that's where it all started.
And you said that he perhaps had toyed with the he had had this idea, sort of had the sentiment, had toyed with the wording just a little bit until he apparently got it the way that he wanted.
Yes.
How did he think about that, and did he think that he was somehow creating something that would have such a remarkable life of its own, or did he really not? Did that particular thing not stand out to him like that?
I don't know the answer for sure, to tell you the truth, but I think he may have thought it was. He would never have congratulated himself about the wording of a prayer. Prayers weren't like that. But I think he must have thought it was okay, because when his neighbor, who was then in Heath, the dean of Washington National Cathedral, who was compiling prayers and for a booklet to be printed for the U.S. Army in its camps overseas, and this was eventually the occupation army in Germany, asked him if he could include this prayer in one of these booklets. And Daddy said, yeah, sure. Mm. So he must have, thought it was okay then. I don't think he had any idea of what would happen to it as a consequence of its being printed in that U.S. Army booklet, which brought it to the attention of Alcoholics Anonymous and other organizations, and then it became super famous. I do remember from my childhood, that was all when I was a baby and I didn't know about it at the time, but I remember from my adolescent years and later in his life, that he found it rather tiring, frankly, to constantly have to explain to people that, yes, indeed, he had written it.
I suppose for someone who had written as much as he had, and a number of books that are for people who are interested in the study of religion are certainly very important, for it to be known for such a small thing, even
right.
though it's a lovely turn of phrase and it's a wonderful sentiment. I suppose you set that against everything else we did. I could understand that it would get tedious after a while for people just to
yes.
latch onto that one tiny little thing.
Right. Well, yes, and his mind was set on his larger works, of course. He was a busy teacher. He had courses to prepare, lectures to give. He preached regularly in college chapels all around the country, so there were sermons and prayers written for virtually every Sunday of the year, and this was but one of many. But I think it also embarrassed him, because a spiritual expression like this is not something over which you should crow and take a lot of credit and brag about. He didn't have that kind of attitude toward it. But on the other hand, he was very happy to know that it was of some use, if that's the right word, to people who found some solace, comfort, and strength in it.
For people who might have just tuned in, I think I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Elizabeth Sifton. She is the Senior Vice President of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, the publisher. She is also the daughter of Reinhold Niebuhr, very well-known American theologian, who was the author of this particular prayer that we have talked about, the Serenity Prayer, and, of course, a lot of other important works of theology. The book that we're talking about here this morning is by Elizabeth Sifton, and it's titled The Serenity Prayer, Faith and Politics in Times of Peace and War, published by W.W. Norton. And as she explained, that she was interested in reading this, in writing this book, was interested in part to talk about where it actually came from, where the prayer came from, the fact that her father did write it because it had been so often misattributed. But also it's about a lot more than that. We'll talk more with her in a second here. Let me just give our telephone number if somebody wants to call in, be part of the conversation. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It is very clear that what he thought, and people that he knew thought, it was very important for people of faith to be engaged.
Yes.
To be engaged politically and socially. And that this is something that I think today we have a hard time deciding whether that should be and how it should be.
Yes.
And I think that it's the tendency of a lot of people now to try to say, well, these worlds really should be separate, and that they think that it's a problem somehow when people of faith, which whether they are conservatives, whether they're liberals, get involved in politics. And I think that his idea was that, well, you're you kind of have an obligation here that if you're a person of faith to be involved in politics and to be involved in social issues and to be engaged. And if you weren't, that there was something wrong. And I guess maybe we could talk about how he thought. Maybe that's a way of starting how you approach this whole thing and how he saw that.
Well, he saw it in a way that many, many other clergymen saw it too, although they were always in the minority. They were members of what are now called the mainstream American Protestant churches. There were also some Catholic priests who worked with them on these matters. And they thought that as Christians, considering the Christian obligation to love one's neighbor and to attend to councils the Christian Council of Perfection to love absolutely carries with it some suggestion that you must attend to trying to make the world a fairer and better place for everyone. Therefore, he thought that this is something that pastors should encourage their congregations to think about. And he found it very, very difficult to do this. He found it very, very hard to get his congregations, when he had a church, which was in Detroit, and before that in Illinois, to get them to think about this as a real-life thing and not just as an abstract thing. It was hard to get them to pay attention to these Christian admonitions or injunctions in their real life, apart from, Sunday mornings. And so he felt that the churches should do something to encourage their congregations to try to make life better for everybody, not just for themselves. And he did not think, however, and he vigorously opposed the idea that the churches should have anything to do with government or with party politics in the sense of forming political parties themselves or attempting to gain control of any kind of government power. That appalled him and appalled everyone that he worked with. There were, for example, there were Christian parties in Europe, but they tended to be very, very conservative, and he opposed those parties in Italy, in Germany, in Spain, even. So his view was that one should take one's Christianity seriously and apply it across the whole spectrum of your life, but not to, and that would require you to have some commitment to programs that would help people in the world. But that didn't mean that you had to try to seize the reins of local, state, or national government on behalf of your church. That was quite inappropriate.
We have someone here calling from a mobile phone, from a car, I guess. So let's bring them into the conversation here on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. My question, could she talk a little bit about the relationship between her father and her uncle, Richard Niebuhr, another great theologian?
Oh, I'd be happy to. And that's a nice question. Thank you for asking it. I mentioned my uncle in my book a little bit, but not enough, I think. I now wish I had spoken about him more. These two brothers were both sons of a pastor in a church in Illinois, and they both became theologians. My uncle, Helmut Richard, taught at the Yale Divinity School while my father was teaching in New York. And actually, their relationship was very close and very affectionate. They loved each other very much. They also had disagreements, and some of their disagreements were about precisely this subject that we've been talking about, which was just how involved in the world should one be as a Christian. How should you interpret the gospel more purely by itself or more fully in the world? And my uncle tended to feel that his brother was getting too involved in politics, was getting too involved in the social fabric problems of the day, and was not keeping the appropriate distance. I'm making a very crude description of what was a very subtle and complicated and nuanced debate between them, which was both about politics and also about theology and about the spiritual life and how one conducts it. they wrote to each other a lot about this, and I wish we had their letters, but I think nobody's been
able
to find them.
Oh, yeah, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
nobody's been able to find them, alas.
Yeah, I'll just offer a testimony as one who went through divinity school in the 80s that the two brothers just stand as the most exciting theologians I've read, and they continue to empower, I think, generations of ministers and theologians out there.
Oh, I certainly hope that's true. Thank you so much for saying so.
Great to get to talk to you.
Thank you.
For the call. Other people have questions, comments, they're certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It is very clear in the book that you are lamenting the loss of liberal, progressive, Protestant activism in this country, and the fact that it seems that as the mainline Protestant denominations have withered somewhat,
mm-hmm.
that you obviously feel that there's something important there that has been lost.
I do feel that. The issue of how a church should behave in a community was, in my opinion, that question of how it should be handled was answered differently by the different denominations. Methodists and Lutherans and Presbyterians and Episcopalians, Baptists, and all the others have different views, subtly different, but importantly different views on how this should be. They had different traditions and stressed different notions of how to behave in the world. How a church should be part of the community and how a church should minister to its people. And these are issues that have great significance, it seems to me, and importance to keep in one's heart and alive. And when they kind of die on the vine and everything gets homogenized into a kind of vague thing called going to church on Sunday, and the sharpness of the terms is lost somewhat, I think we all lose out. And I think what's happening now in public conversation in America about issues of faith and public life is very incoherent and smudgy because we've lost the certain attention to detail that we once had. Hmm. Does that make any sense? I'm not sure if I've
got... Yeah, well, I guess it... I suppose there's some people would say that on the for conservative and evangelical Protestant denominations, it's not smudgy at all, and that those people are engaged from the direction that they believe is right, and that so obviously there seems to be a clarity there.
Yes. Yes, but as I say in my book, and as my father said, and as his colleagues all said. This is an old, old issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's a false clarity. One of the points I've tried to make in my book, because my father made it himself so often, and his friends and like-minded, and his brother and his like-minded colleagues, was that the issue of having a religious faith and sticking to it is never an easy one. Faith is challenged and threatened by life crises, by all kinds of problems, both inner and outer. And they had a tremendous respect for people who had moments of doubt or uncertainty. And they respected that. They quoted scripture to show that even in the Bible, Jesus recognizes the moments when people are uncertain and are not clear what the faith should be. So he always opposed the ministers and the churches who insisted rigidly that if you went along with them and believed in things the way they believed in them, you had it all down pat and everything was absolutely certain. That was a false certainty, and he disliked it, especially because it came along with rigid and disapproving social criticisms that he didn't find very Christian, frankly. Bigoted often, or harsh about unbelievers, about people of different faiths, about people who were not towing the line the way they were towing the line. And he didn't find that kind of Christian community a very welcoming or reassuring one.
So why do you think that it is, I mean, perhaps we've already provided an answer to that question, but why do you think that it is that particularly over the last couple of decades that those more conservative fundamentalist, evangelical, Christian denominations, Protestant denominations have, whatever kinds of label you want to apply, have been the ones that have experienced such dramatic growth, and the others, perhaps more left-leaning, mainline Protestant denominations, they haven't. I mean, what is the difference, you think, the fact that on the one side there is the offer of some absolutes and some real assurance, and that that people like that, and the more difficult, the more smudgy, that people just feel uncomfortable with that?
Well, I can't say, really. I think there are lots of different things going on. There's not one reason that the fundamentalist churches have grown a lot. But one is certainly that in a very confusing and difficult and complicated world, they seem to offer some simple solutions. They also have a lot of money, and they also, and so they're able to proselytize and to gain adherence. They've also used television very cleverly and aggressively to increase their numbers, and their services. And here I'm going to sound more conservative than liberal. Their services are weirdly, to my mind, are weirdly secular. They don't feel so very different from the sound of the culture in general. Whereas I had always been brought up to believe that church service should not be like anything else. That it has a special quality, and I should say this would be true of any ceremony or service in any faith, not just a church service. But the church services were the ones I knew, and the church services were supposed to propose a different way of thinking about the world and about our relations with one another and our relations with our faith. And they shouldn't be too secularized, too commercialized, too gooped up with the sounds of the culture in at large. The most extreme example of this would be a Quaker meeting, of course, where you don't have any sound at all except what people want to talk about. But I think a kind of easy reassurance and an easy way of insisting on the doctrines makes the fundamentalist churches attractive to people who don't want to think too much about any of this. By this, I mean who don't want to think too hard about these deeper questions of one's faith and how it relates to everything.
Were there in your father's family, were there other people who were clergymen or theologians or people whose career was religion?
Well, I've mentioned that my uncle, was also a theologian. His sister, my aunt, was a teacher of religious education in Chicago, at McCormick Theological Seminary, and before that for years at a church in New York. His father had been a minister. His father came from Germany in 1881 and got religion when he came to America, and studied for the ministry and had a pastorate in Lincoln, Illinois for decades. And it was in his church that my father first preached and worked. My mother was a scholar of biblical theology and a teacher of religion at Barnard College in New York. In my generation, I have a cousin who's been at the Harvard Divinity School, and my cousin and his son, my first cousin once removed, Gus Niebuhr, is a journalist who writes about religion. But I think that about covers it.
Well, I guess the reason that I'm asking is that you can see from this and other cases that religion as a profession sometimes does run in families. But of course, children of ministers are famously, I'm not sure to what extent this is an unjust stereotype, but are famously wild.
That's right. That
often do as much rebel as follow in the footsteps.
That's right.
Which was the case with you?
Well, I was a kind of mild rebel. I I didn't have a wild youth, I don't think. I didn't think of it as particularly wild, and I didn't think my parents did. But I certainly told them when I was a teenager that I didn't believe in any of this stuff. I didn't believe the story in the Bible. The stories in the Bible, the miracles, the resurrection, the virgin, all of this stuff seemed most implausible to me. I announced, and I didn't want to have any more to do with it, and I wasn't going to go to church and everything. They were quite patient about that and said that it was a difficult thing. They weren't going to press the point. They did not denounce me and run me out of the house for this lack of faith. And I have found myself drifting back to it in as the years progressed. When one of my sons was about 10 or so, our local church encouraged him to sing in the choir, and I began going back to that church and bringing my children to it, too. So I drifted back in a sort of a way.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Elizabeth Sifton. She is the daughter of one of America's best-known, greatest theologians, Reinhold Niebuhr. She herself has made her living in the publishing world she's been an editor and book publisher for 40 years. She is now the senior vice president of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And she is the author of The Serenity Prayer, Faith and Politics in Times of Peace and War, published by W.W. Norton, which is just out recently, and it is, as we have explained in part, about how it is her father came to compose this very well-known prayer, but also about his feeling, and perhaps hers as well, that for people of faith it was very important that they be engaged, that they be in the world, that they pay attention to political and social issues, and that they participate in that. And if you're interested in reading the story, you can head out to the bookstore and take a look at it. And of course, here on this program, if you have questions, you're welcome to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have someone next to talk with locally here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I believe it was Reinhold Niebuhr who was quoted on a T-shirt that I have, which is unfortunately packed away for the season. The front of my T-shirt says straight but not narrow. And the back is the quote about, and I can't, maybe you can, I know there are lots of quotes from this fellow, but I don't know if you happen to know it offhand, about first they came for the, was it Jews first, and I didn't do anything, and then they came for the, and
yes.
So forth and so on. Do you remember? Can you?
I can't quote it exactly, and it's not my father, but it was somebody whom he knew and admired.
Ah, okay.
There was a German pastor named Martin Niemöller.
Oh, okay.
Who had a church in Berlin, and he said, and I wish I knew the quotation exactly because you're right, it's kind of terrific, but what he said, and he was speaking of Germans and German Christians and people in his church, that first they came, meaning the Nazis, first they came for the Jews, and we didn't do anything, and then they came for communists and socialists, and we didn't do anything, and then they came, and eventually they came for us.
Right.
And by that time, of course, there wasn't any us, because the Nazis had destroyed everything. I mean, that's the meaning of the phrase.
And
if you
use the two people, okay, thanks.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
If you watch while a government or a political force of some kind first destroys one segment of the population, and you say, well, that doesn't have to do with me, so I don't have to worry about it. And then it destroys another section of the population, and you say, that it's still not about me. And then again and again, and then you look around you and realize there's nobody there, mm-hmm. and you're all alone. And then they come for you, too. So that was what Niemöller was saying. That it was wrong for the Germans to think that, as just as it would be for any group of people. That when people are threatened, we must all come to their aid, and that was what Niemöller's. But so it was Niemöller, not Niebuhr.
Well, thank you very much. I apologize.
No. He was a fellow anti-fascist fighter and a very brave and good man.
Well, I think that. This whole issue of gays is one of those things where we can stand up and prevent the sort of thing that developed gradually in Germany, but we all have to stand up and speak out whenever we have the chance. And
that's exactly right. A few days ago, someone asked me what my father would have thought about the issue of gay clergymen, and I don't know. I can't say that because it hadn't come up as an issue in his lifetime. But I do know what he thought about the issue of women priests, which did come up during his lifetime, and about which he felt quite strongly. And what he said about that perhaps suggests a way of thinking about the issue about gays in the church, too. He said about the opposition to having women priests that it was almost never expressed in sort of true theological terms. It was described as sinful or wrong or not sanctioned by the Bible, but then just dropped. Whereas the real issue, and the reason it became so fervent and acrid even and bitter, was because it was about political power. And it was about not wanting to relinquish a kind of political power that had excluded people and that had kept certain categories of people, namely women, or as we discuss now, gays, out of political control within the organizations of the church. So it was a political dispute, and not really a dispute on the merits.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go next to line number 3. That will be the next caller, and Champagne. Hello.
Oh, hello. Mm-hmm. It was Martin Niemöller who made that quote.
Yes.
That's correct. I met and heard your father when at Union Seminary back in the 60s, and he would come out, and even though he had suffered the effects of a stroke, he would fulminate periodically about the war in Vietnam.
Yes, indeed.
At the time. And it may be unfair to ask you to extrapolate once again from what you know of your father's views about what he might think of the current administration's Iraq policy.
Well, I don't think it's hard to extrapolate at all, because his record of comment on American foreign policy and American behavior during the Second World War, at the end of the Second World War, during the problem in the early years after the war, when we were dealing with the rise of nuclear weaponry, his as you nicely remember, his appalled dismay about our war in Vietnam. That's a very straight line. There is nothing that could persuade me that he would condone in any way, respect, or form the Bush administration's war in Iraq. The fact that Saddam Hussein was a vile dictator is incontrovertible. But there were international laws and international sanctions in place against his regime, and to force him to come to terms with the international community's rebuke of him should have required, still does require, international and multilateral efforts to go it alone in contradiction to international law and custom, to go it alone and invade a sovereign country in order to kill or take out its head of state. This is not something he would ever, ever, ever supported. And I should add that the tone of righteousness, we are a godly nation and we know what we're doing and we're good at it and people will be thankful for us, was a tone of pride that he always deplored in American actions overseas. He thought we should be a lot more modest when we dealt with the rest of the world, especially because we were so powerful, rich, and strong.
Yeah, that jives exactly with what I remember of him and what I have read about him, that, you know, above all, we need, even though we must take stands, we need to be modest about our own virtue.
Absolutely, always. And he always felt that American politicians tended to forget this over and over and over again. He didn't think American people forgot it, but he thought American politicians did.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, pleasure talking to you.
Thanks
for the call. Let's go to the next person in Philo. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My father was a student of yours at Union.
And I, being a preacher's kid, I was intrigued by the comment. I've never liked the idea of the terming of preacher's children as being wild. We're just, you know, children of clergymen.
Right.
And sometimes I think people put a different standard on that for some reason. You know, if we question the Bible, then there's something wrong with us. If somebody else does it, there isn't so much wrong with it. And I was, my father always taught me that there was no absolute truth.
That's right. And that's what I learned, too. And as I tried to say, I was encouraged to believe that it was never easy to understand exactly what all these mysterious and difficult commands of the faith were, and that one could falter or fall by the wayside and then get up and try to keep going. And perhaps it is true that children of clergymen understand this, have it built in a little bit more than others. It may also be true that very strict disciplinarian clergymen may run the risk of having wild children. I don't know. But I agree with you that the whole situation is a good deal more nuanced than perhaps the cartoons allow.
Yeah, I mean, you relayed the thing of how you said that you didn't believe in all that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, I maybe not as strident as you express it, but I expressed similar feelings and questions. And my father's reaction was, okay, you know, we'll see.
We'll see, exactly. Yeah, we'll
you know, see. And, you know, I'm a member of the church. I go to church. And, you know, so it's not a problem to question things. It's what you should do.
And it's also a question of how the thing plays out in your mind and heart. I remember when I mentioned that my son became a choir boy in a local church, and I said to my mother, who was very approving of this, I said, yes, but don't you realize I've never met a grown person who was a choir boy who wasn't an atheist? So we're facing that with my son. And she said, yes, but it never leaves them, really.
Yeah.
So she understood that even when people say they're atheists, they may still have residues or remnants of the teachings or the experience of service or the experience of worship, which they never lose.
I think if I remember something my dad said to me once, that atheism was a religion too.
Yes.
It's the same thing. Not the same thing, but it's a religion. It's a faith in not believing in anything.
That's right. That's right. And I think I think there's another kind of atheism, which is a strident hatred of all things religious, that makes me very sad because it's so hysterical and seems so unnecessarily harsh.
Yeah.
As if, in fact, the very idea of faith frightened the people who go on like that.
Yeah.
So I don't support, although I'm a fierce believer in the separation of church and state, I don't support the kind of secular people who insist that any expression of religious faith in the public space is outlawed. I don't think that's possible or plausible.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up the issue of the under God thing and the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, is it really necessary to make that such a big deal out of that? I mean, you can't ask that question. You know, I don't know. But I think that it made a lot of people really angry at, you know, people that are more tolerant than the evangelicals or the fundamentalists who wanted to say, okay, that's the way it should be.
The Pledge of Allegiance didn't even exist until 1892.
Yeah.
And there were many Christians and fundamentalists who at the time thought that the Pledge of Allegiance was a sort of ungodly worship of a flag and therefore inappropriate. But now it's become embedded in the kind of secular, worship of the nation, and now it's considered sacrosanct. But it went along quite happily from 1892 until 1953 with no mention of God in it. And it was only then when the Knights of Columbus mounted a big campaign to add under God at a time when the United States imagined it was in battle against godless communism that they added these two words. And now everybody is hysterical about keeping it in.
Yeah.
You'd think all of these things have been inscribed in stone by George Washington 200 years ago, but it's far from true.
Yeah. Well, it was really nice talking to you.
Well,
good,
thank you for the call.
All right.
We're coming down to just having a couple of minutes left. There were so many things that we could talk about. I guess one of the things that I'm interested in, and I think is striking, as the way you describe your growing up and your family and the people who were family friends, is that your dad and mom and were very much involved and very close to a lot of really interesting people, important thinkers, and only some of them were people who were professionally in the business of religion.
That's right.
And it seemed that the very mixed and diverse group.
It was mixed and diverse and wonderful, I must say. I was blessed and very lucky. I think the culture had a lively mixture then. It was possible to be a working teacher in a divinity school, as my father was, and meet poets and writers and union organizers and musicians and all kinds of different kinds of people in a way that perhaps our modern life doesn't allow for. But it was also true that his own interest in these different aspects of American life encouraged him to have these friends. So W.H. Auden, the English poet who came to America during the war and who was very interested in theology and returned to the church, having gone away from it in his 20s and 30s, became a great friend in the 1940s, and he was a wonderfully exciting and interesting person. My father liked the company of politicians, and he was close to a number of labor leaders, notably Walter Reuther of the United Automobile Workers, and Victor Reuther, his brother. And so they were friends of the family also. And then, of course, there was Justice Frankfurter. He was justice by the time I knew him, when in Heath, Massachusetts, our neighbor in the hills of Massachusetts. And he was a very sparky, lively character, and always terrifically nice to the children of his friends.
Yeah.
So they were an amazing bunch.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we've used the time, and we're going to have to stop. For people who are listening, if you're interested in reading more about Reinhold Niebuhr, a great American theologian, you can look for this book that we've mentioned. It's titled The Serenity Prayer, Faith and Politics in Times of Peace and War, by our guest Elizabeth Sifton, who is the daughter of Reinhold Niebuhr. She's also worked for a lot of her life in the publishing business. She is the senior vice president at the publisher Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Ms. Sifton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.